All right, so continuing our discussion of microeconomics, we're going to really zoom in here to what that looks like if you would like to start a business. So what types of businesses did you guys come up with? Again, sole proprietor is one. If you don't know all the fancy terms, we can just try to think of some categories. So what do you think? Nailed it. Yeah, franchise. What's an example of a franchise? Yeah, McDonald's, classic franchise. One of the first in our country, in fact. What's another example? Well, Chick-fil-A would fall under what?
Okay.
A franchise, absolutely. So,
oh, sorry.
Yeah, no, I didn't communicate that well. What's another type of business? Yeah, entrepreneur. So you have an idea and you're risking your own money. Entrepreneur is a French word meaning to undertake. So you're starting a business, and that could mean any number of things. And so what types of businesses might that entrepreneur start? So we've covered sole proprietor, meaning you're going solo. That's one of the neat things about business. You can do whatever you want. You can include as many people as you want. Or not. You start a franchise, meaning that you're providing a good or service in a similar, if not identical, format in multiple locations. What other types of businesses might we see? Say again?
Partnership.
Yes, a partnership. So the idea of starting a business is scary. For one, if you're an entrepreneur, you're risking your own money. That means you stand to get a lot of money or not. You might lose your money. You might be going to a bank and borrowing that money, in which case you're in huge debt if your business goes bankrupt. You might even have to declare bankruptcy, meaning this could be your one shot at starting a business. So it would be a smart move if there's someone you can trust with my partner. Anybody else? Yeah.
Would resale be
good? Like resale? That could even fall under department stores. And when we're thinking eBay, we're getting into like big time corporate stuff.
Yeah.
So corporations are a type of business, and we'll be looking at those too. Okay, so let's start our little baby business, and we're going to try to grow it and hit corporate level by the end of today's lesson. So, businesses operate under a certain set of rules that aren't always the same as the rules that individuals play by, and you'll see some of the differences. So we'll start with a proprietorship. A proprietorship. This is the most common form of business. These are what we call small businesses. They are the simplest, and the simplest of those is the sole proprietorship. And there are some advantages to being a sole proprietor. Number one, the freedom that you have. If you want to sell stickers. If you want to make stuffed animals, you do whatever you want. The only constraint is that the product has to be legal. Your means of obtaining said product have to be legal. I mean, you play by the same rules as anything else. Otherwise, you charge what you want for it. You keep what you make. And then when your income reaches a certain point, then yes, you'll be paying taxes on it. eBay even does that for you automatically. They're like, oh, I'm small time in the eBay world, so I don't actually have to pay taxes on my income. My buyers have to pay taxes, sales taxes, but I'm not yet taxed on income yet. Once I get a certain point, at that point, it becomes a business, and there's even a separate distinction between eBay. So it's easy to start. You can start your eBay account in minutes. And you can post your first item within 10 minutes. It's easy to start a business. It's easy to make decisions about your business. Every so often, I look through my inventory and lower some prices, provide some incentives, and I communicate directly with my buyers. There's no middleman. And of course, the beauty of this is taxes are lower. There are some disadvantages. For one, I'm lucky in that it's not my day job. It's just a side hustle. And I don't have any debt associated with my business. I've acquired all of these random things just, kind of like y'all mentioned, as a resale opportunity. Some of them I bought, I'm just getting rid of. Some of them I inherited and I don't need. So I have no debt associated with this. If I did, I am a 100% liable for that. Not only that, but unlimited liability means that if a customer is unhappy with my product, I have to refund them. And I had to do that. I mean, eBay provides me a yearly statement, losses versus revenue. And I lose several hundred dollars a year due to returns. So again, it's small time, but it's still significant. If someone wants a refund, I haven't encountered a situation where I've won that argument yet. eBay's going to lean on the side of the consumer. So I'm liable. It's also difficult to raise capital because if I'm small time, then my sales aren't going through the roof. And if I am going to raise capital, it's going to take quite some time. I'm going to have to begin to invest. I'm going to have to, if I stick with the antique thing, I'd have to start going to estate sales. I'd have to start investing real money. And it would take a long time to get to be any type of big player. I am nowhere near the point of hiring someone. And if I were, that would be a very stressful position to be. Because in the world of work, you'll find that good people are scarce. And that you get what you pay for in the working world, just like in everything else. And so if you're trying to keep your labor costs low, then finding talent and attracting good people is going to be a challenge. So you're more likely to be overworking yourself for several years starting a business. I mean, folks I know who have started usually live at the site. They run things out of their home, or if they have a commercial property, they live upstairs. Okay, so would it be easy and fun to run a business? I hope you're getting the impression that it's not easy. Would it be fun? Well, that's relative, right? Let's see. Gray, can you hear me? Gray Thompson?
Yeah, I'm here.
Hey, if you were to start a business, what do you think you'd do?
If I were to start a business, it would probably be something art-oriented, like based on stuff that I can create either for commissions for other people or just create and then sell.
You said artwork-oriented?
Yeah.
Oh, that's awesome. Okay, so you would create something and then maybe produce it for clients and then sell it. Okay, that's really cool. So potentially there could be a low overhead there. And then depending on the type of work you're doing, it's definitely a lot of effort, but it sounds like that's something you'd enjoy, right?
Yeah, I'd very much enjoy it.
It would be so cool. So it's just a matter of figuring out how to monetize that. Okay, now, making work that could be monetized, I imagine that'd be a lot of work, wouldn't it? Or what do you think?
Yeah, it definitely would be difficult to start off at the very least because it's hard to get publicity in the early stages.
No, you're right. And I mean, some of you guys are so talented that you could probably just produce amazing things in a simple way. But I think you hit on a good point there that increasing your market base, ooh, that's not easy. It's easy and fun to run your own business. You know, I've been doing this YouTube thing since 2015, and I've made hundreds of videos at this point. And I'd say I'm like a third of the way towards sponsorship. Not that it's ever really going to amount to anything. I'm making for y'all, but just out of curiosity, again, you know, my likes and side hustles, I've always been interested, would this turn into a business? And I've had to learn the hard way that there are people who are way better at YouTube than I am, even on the educational front. And they invest enormous amounts of energy, and the best ones are investing quite a bit of capital as well, production costs and so forth. So I'm not in a place where I can compete on any significant level. I feel like I can make some good content, but I don't think I'm ready to make a business out of it. Okay, the next type of business, and we hit on this one, is a partnership. And I've been watching Crash Course videos since the early days. When John Green first began, it was his high school history teacher who had an idea to make videos for the benefit of their students, in particular to prepare them for their AP exams. And that was it. So they were really on the same level I was once upon a time. And they began to produce these videos, the two of them working together. His teacher did the research and production. John Green was the host of these video series. And their very first one was on American history. And so I've been using it for quite a long time. And even from the early days, they had a pretty good production going. For what it was shoestring, but they did okay. And as a partnership, they worked well together. And over time, as their fan base grew, as their subscribers began to grow, and they reached a market audience, they were picked up by PBS. And so now they have a lucrative sponsorship and partnership with a larger entity. But it began as just these two people, which I think is really neat. And I would imagine it's rather lucrative for them at this point. I don't think it's made millions, but I think they do okay. So it's run jointly by two or more owners. And in terms of the complications, it's as complicated as they want to make it. If you're going to go into a formal business with someone, there are legal documents that you can agree to, that you can use, tools that you can use, because even if it's your best friend, it might not work out. You might have a falling out. Going into business together is very stressful. It's like a marriage. It's all peaches, rainbows, and butterflies at first. But sometimes preparing for the worst can be a smart one. So that's where the articles of partnership come in. Okay, the advantages. Strength in numbers. If you have partners, they're invested. If you have employees, they're not invested. Now, those of you guys who work for hourly wages, if you bust your tail and work your hands to the bone, those hourly wages don't increase. You have very little financial incentive to work hard versus not working hard, which means that many hourly employees, even many salaried employees, will only work as hard as necessary to stay out of trouble. Partners, meanwhile, have a financial incentive to work hard because not only are they included in the company they're invested with their own money. Now, partnerships can grow. You can start out with 2, you can wind up with 20. In fact, many family medical practices are partnerships. I mean, several doctors get together and say, let's rent an office space and we'll work together. Let's share some administrative staff. And that's the family practice I go see is a partnership. Now, with partnerships, there's no corporate taxes. And we'll come back to what that means in a little bit. And also, of course, if Gray and I were to go in business together, I have no clue and no talent when it comes to art. But Gray might approach me and say, can you help me with the business side? You're like, okay, I know enough to at least get started. And so we could partner, I could do the business side, and Gray could do the talent side. There are disadvantages. For one, if my partner and I have a falling out, it's a mess. It might just be simpler to dissolve the business. Because splitting it in any sort of way, buying out the partner, selling the business, splitting the proceeds, it gets complicated. And the 2 of us or the 5 of us are still liable for whatever. Okay. Think about it this way. If you have a space where your business is hosted, and someone comes to that place and gets hurt because anything can happen, or they're using your product. Let's say you're selling online. But they use your product and get hurt? Oh, right? You're in a sticky situation. Let's say I go to my parents' house, I get that Lego set, I put it all together, package it nicely, sell it for a decent amount, and then some kid chokes on it. Am I responsible? eBay's lawyers have something to do with that. I hope they do, because those things happen. So the next level of business is a corporation. Now, corporations are really interesting. And this is the point where your business has become profitable, you go public with it. Going public with it means that now you're opening up the opportunity for individuals to invest in your company. And just like a sole proprietorship, those people who are invested in your company are entitled to a share of the profits. And so that means you can sell stocks. You can sell little pieces of your company. So instead of you and a partner going 50-50, or you and 3 people going thirds, it's you and potentially millions of people who own now this piece of the company. So this means your company's grown quite a bit. And you're going to need some leadership and some direction, because now you are involved in a business that is serving many people and that is responsible for generating revenue for many people. Now, this board of directors would likely have nothing to do with the business itself. If you're making hamburgers, they've likely never flipped a burger. They're your lawyer types. They're your business associates. And it is their responsibility to ensure that the corporation is as profitable as possible. And they'll hire managers to do the business side, to actually run the places. So for one, there are many advantages. If you go public with your company, it's easy to raise funds. Because now split pieces of your company into shares, you can still retain control by having the controlling percentage of shares, that's 51%. But assuming that your business is big enough to do this,
That means you can farm out the investment. You can seek capital from that other 49%. And you can grow your business to be huge. In fact, you may even reach the point where you hire professionals to manage your business. And all you do is collect the money. That's pretty sweet, right? So you hit the point where other people are running things for you. All you have to do is cash the check. And one of the beauties of being a corporation is you have limited liability. Limited liability. See, if McDonald's tanks and goes into debt, the corporation itself becomes responsible for the debt, not the owners or the stockholders. Meaning that if you purchase a piece of Cracker Barrel, the value of that share may go up or down, but you'll never go into debt because of that share. That's up to Cracker Barrel. Now, if they go bankrupt because they're in too much debt, your share may become worthless, but you'll never have to owe money. Okay, one of the big disadvantages is this is not something many of us are likely to do. Very expensive to start a business, and then it's a lengthy process to get big. And at the point that you've gone corporate, you're no longer completely in control of your company, because you've handed control over to this board of directors. You can retain the largest portion of the shares, but you might not. Meaning this board of directors might wind up having more power than the person who started the business. There's also quite a few rules that go into corporations and how they work. You know, the bigger something gets, the more complicated it gets. And also, there's a double taxation. Corporation has to pay taxes on their profits, and then stockholders have to pay taxes on their dividends. So that means shareholders are taxed twice on the same money. You can still make lots of money doing this, but it's certainly very complicated. The next type of business, and Ella kind of mentioned this with Goodwill. Or was it Goodwill that you mentioned, resale stores?
Yeah, so
a good chunk of when we cleaned out my grandparents' house, you know, Dad and I found a few things that we thought would be worth selling. But most of it we donated to Goodwill. And then Goodwill sift through that and decide if there's anything worth selling. And they run a business off that. But Goodwill is a nonprofit. In fact, their business model is that they will hire folks who might otherwise have a hard time getting work, and they will help them be successful. And they will teach them how to maintain employment, and they really provide a great opportunity for folks who might not otherwise be able to hold a key job. And so as a result, they're able to retain nonprofit steps, and they're run very similar to a corporation, but in terms of their profits versus losses, they as a company don't generate revenue. Their CEO makes lots of money. Their board of directors makes lots of money. The managers of that, you know, these people are still earning a living within these nonprofits. Think churches, for example. Churches are nonprofits. They don't generate revenue. Their balance sheets are zeroed out even each year. They spend the money that they make. Pastors make a living. Counselors, choir directors, all the folks associated with church staff, they make a living. You can do that as a profession. But again, the company itself is a nonprofit.
And there are some advantages to working this way as well. Hospitals, social services, or even cooperatives.
Talking about section 2, chapter 22, and it's all about the American worker. And the big idea that we're working off here is that market economies, that is, an economy based on free trade, rests on the fundamental principle of individual freedom for consumers. That means if you're like me and you didn't see anything you wanted on Cyber Monday, you didn't buy anything. The robot vacuum looked kind of cool, but not $200 cool. So I exercised my free will as a consumer to not buy anything. Had I seen something I wanted? Maybe. And that's my right, my individual freedom as a consumer. But there's also an individual freedom for producers, right? If makers of said robot vacuum didn't want to make robot vacuum, no one's making them. They don't have to make robot vacuum. They can go back to telling you to sweep with a broom. It's their business if they want to make robot vacuum or not. And then finally, for workers. If you want to get a job, get a job. If you don't, well, things get more complicated, obviously. But it's still your choice. You can choose not to get a job. You can choose to get a job. That's how a market economy works. No one is putting a gun to your head and making you buy, make, or work. And that's something that we value as a country. So, of course, a few terms you'll see, labor union, right to work, a few different political terms. Of course, we'll talk about strikes, boycotts. What rights, what powers do you have as an employee? And, of course, there's always the classic question, are labor unions good for American business? Business owners and executives would strongly argue no. Why? Because it drives up the cost of labor, which in essence drives up the cost of production, right? If I have to pay you more to make a cheeseburger, I have to charge more for the cheeseburger. We know what price does to demand, meaning I will sell less cheeseburgers, meaning that the world will be filled with fewer cheeseburgers. If you just look at it from the business standpoint, treating workers good equates to more expensive stuff. But if you look at it from the worker's perspective, again, that's what we're going to focus on today. The labor unions play an important role in the nation's economy and political life. So first off, a labor union. I just want to define it simply. It's an association of workers that are organized. You know, the two basic reasons that workers would organize are better wages and better working conditions. You know, if we had to take this class in a bunker that had no windows, it was underground, it had no ventilation, it'd be pretty miserable. I would probably quit after a year. You guys would find a better school to go to. None of us want to have to take a class five levels underground in a bunker with no windows, no ventilation. It just feels depressing to me. We'd want better working conditions. And honestly, we expect to be paid decently for what we do. Now here's the reality. The labor movement is almost something we talk about in past tense. Because today, only about 14% of the American workforce are involved in a labor union. Whether that's the North Carolina Educators Association, the NCEA, whether that's the Teamsters, whether that's the AFL-CIO, whether that's any other particular type of labor union, it only represents 14% of this country. Okay, so two basic types of unions. You've got craft or trade unions. You know, maybe this is the United Auto Workers. That'd be the folks working for Ford, for General Motors, which, by the way, did you notice that General Motors has announced they're going to be laying off thousands of their employees? That announcement was just made yesterday. thousands of employees are going to be laid off by General Motors, which represents what? Ford, Dodge, and Chrysler, three of the big American automakers. And then finally, industrial unions. So you have craft or trade unions like the Writers Guild. You have industrial unions like the United Auto Workers. But there are also different types of organization. There are local unions. I would imagine there's some type of Henderson County association. There's certainly a Henderson County branch of the North Carolina Association of Educators. There are also national unions. One of the largest labor unions in the country is the AFL-CIO, the American Federation of Labor and the Congress of Industrial Organizations. Nationwide union. Its history is fascinating. Basically, you have smaller craft unions who were still getting fired, still getting blacklisted, joining together and forming a national arrangement. So what powers do unions have? So once upon a time, when workers would unionize, they would exercise such a great degree of power, unions became so successful that many would even require closed shops. That means, let's say you want to be a brewer, so you apply for a job at New Belgium. That's your thing, you want to be a brewer. Great. Well, there's a brewer's union. There's a craft beer guild. And if you're going to work at New Belgium, and if they are a closed shop, you would have to be a part of that union, meaning you would have to prove your solidarity to even get to walk in the door. Those today are now illegal. So once upon a time, union shops would require workers to join the union after they're being hired. Today you have a choice. You know, I can choose to join the North Carolina Association of Educators, or I can choose not to. That's called a modified union shop, meaning by law, there can be no repercussions for me joining the teachers' union. By law, there can be no repercussions for me exercising my right to take a personal day if the union chooses to go on strike. However, there can also be no consequence for me choosing not to participate. And this is where work laws come in. You've heard this term thrown around quite a bit in this course. It's a political term that is often used by Republicans to describe a state, and let me define it for you, that forbids unions from forcing workers to join. Now, it actually goes a little further than that, too. It also prohibits unions from exercising collective bargaining. Now, collective bargaining would be, for example, if you, as the students of civics and economics, were unhappy with this course, Lauren comes to talk to me about it. And Lauren says, I'm unhappy with this class. I don't like it. You're ugly. Okay. I'm going to say, well, that's too bad, Lauren. I'll tell you what, there's civics being offered on the other wing. You can take that. There's civics offered at Blue Ridge. It's called political science. Okay, you can take that. Bottom line, if you're unhappy, leave. Now, she's never said that, so I'm just picking on her. But if all of you were to come to me and say, you're unhappy with this class, well, then I might be more likely to acquiesce because, well, I've got to keep my job. Ideally, I've got to have students in the room to teach a class. So, in a right-to-work state, you would have no rights to come to me as a group and have that conversation. You couldn't. By law, you could not come to talk to me. I would not sit down with you. I would be within my rights to say, I don't have time to talk to you about that. That's a right-to-work state. Now imagine you're a much larger group. Say you're the entire student body of Henderson County. The student government of Henderson County has decided that the students of Henderson County Public Schools are unhappy with their working conditions. I don't know. I mean, maybe their buildings smell or something. Who knows? Maybe let's call it crumbling infrastructure has led to poor working conditions. Okay. You have no right to talk to me about it. Let's say I'm Bo Caldwell, superintendent. You have no right. That's a right to work state. Does that make sense? Now, the reason I bring that up is what recourse do you have? What can you do if I'm not willing to talk to you? Now, again, I am theoretically as representing Bo Caldwell. If the superintendent exercising his right as a right to work state refuses collective bargaining rights, meaning you as the students have come to Bo Caldwell and said, we need better buildings to work in, or blah, 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 blah. What's your other recourse if they won't talk? Strike, yes, you can leave. En masse, all students of Henderson County quit. It's kind of extreme, right? So if they won't talk to you, that's the only recourse you have, which is the situation North Carolina is currently in. Since management will not meet with labor, and since management is not required by law to meet with labor, the only recourse North Carolina workers have is to quit. So that's what a right to work state is. Anyway, it is the job of the National Labor Relations Board to regulate labor and working conditions. Okay. Secondly, let's say that you are unhappy with your workplace conditions. Let me unpack collective bargaining since I've already mentioned it. Collective bargaining is the process by which unions and employers negotiate the conditions of employment. This one's important. So let's say, for example, you go to work at McDonald's and you tell McDonald's, hey, I'd like to work for you guys, but I'm only available on Saturdays. I don't wake up early on Saturdays, by the way, so I'm going to work from about noon until I'm tired, which is usually around 4. You guys cool with that? Would you hire me at McDonald's if I told you that? No. Only Saturdays, noon to 4. That's when I'm good because I go out with my friends after that. Am I going to get a job? No. Now, collective bargaining would mean that if all McDonald's employees came together and negotiated conditions for their hire, there'd be a process. Now, no one would expect McDonald's to go along with the 12 to 4 only on Saturdays. However, there are reasonable requests that can be made. 40 hours per week. Overtime if it exceeds that. Benefits if I'm full-time required by ACA. Etc. Reasonable request that can be made conditional through the collective bargaining process. Meaning that we, the McDonald's worker, feel that we deserve a safe and clean working environment. So, negotiations, of course, focus on wages. Ultimately, if you're going to work at McDonald's, you want to know, if I'm starting at this, do I have an opportunity to rise? And am I going to be paid a fair and living wage? Did you guys hear about all the Amazon drama? What was the Amazon drama with wages? Yeah, so what are they paying now?
Aren't they paying a living wage now?
They are required now, they are paying $15 an hour. Starting out, $15 an hour. But when you think about what they have to do in there, it's hard work. So wages, that was something that was fought for, that was negotiated for, and that the workers ultimately won the right. Healthcare. And we've also talked about this. If you work in fast food, often those companies will keep you below full time. Why would they keep you below full time? This happened to my mom when she worked at Walmart, too.
So they can do it off the benefits.
benefits so they don't have to provide health care. Because by law, if I employ you full time, I have to provide some type of benefits package. And so the loophole that companies have found is, well, I'm just not going to employ you full time. Well, that's not fair to you. Certainly good for them. It's not right, but that's what they're doing. And so workers may approach management. And again, if you're thinking McDonald's or Walmart, you're needing to think about tens of thousands of workers to impact a company like that to negotiate the idea of health care or even holidays. Ultimately, it comes down to working conditions. Are you happy where you work? For example, there was a rumor about the making of Red Dead Redemption 2 that the workers on the game, the programmers, were unhappy with their working conditions and quit. Now, the rumor was actually put to an end because the folks at Rockstar came out and said, actually, we're pretty happy. There was a group they were contracting, like a third-party group they were contracting through, that was unhappy that they're no longer affiliated with. Bottom line, the folks were like, yeah, we're good. We're paid well. Our office space is fine. Our hours are okay. Our healthcare benefits package is good. We enjoy making this video game. Which, by the way, do you know was bigger than Infinity War? Did you guys hear that? That Red Dead Redemption 2 had a bigger opening weekend than any movie, show, or album, or any type of media that has ever been produced? A $975 million opening weekend for a video game. Okay, enough said.
Yeah, you gotta play it.
So, you know, all this is nice in theory because ultimately we don't have these rights in North Carolina. That's what makes me grumpy about this process. Perfect world, you hate your job, not just because the people or whatever, but because of something genuine and reasonable. So you've decided to go through the collective bargaining process. At this point, it's not just you filing a grievance, though that is a right you have, certainly, and we can talk about that later. But you as a group of workers in this certain place, or workers representing even a larger industry like Ingalls workers in general, what can you do? Well, mediation is where the union and company officials would bring a third party. That means they would hire a professional mediator, someone to facilitate the conversation. You can do this on a personal level with your friends. Miss Willingham serves as a mediator all the time for friend drama, but even in the legal sense, mediators do this for a living. And then finally, you may even choose arbitration. And this is very formal. This is actually generally involved in a court of law, in a civil suit, where the workers file grievance, a formal grievance in a court of law, and the judge, serving as the arbiter, would make a decision. Okay, so what tools do labor have? Since collective bargaining was taken away from workers in North Carolina, as we are a right-to-work state, the main tool that we have is to go on strike. And so that's why teachers demonstrated their solidarity in the spring by going on strike. Now, we only elected for one day. It was really just a show of power to say, hey, there are millions of us that will shut down schools around the state if you mess with us. Don't make us do it. And, you know, had it come to that, then we would have gone on strike and shut down the schools in the state of North Carolina. Now, that didn't happen here, but it did happen in West Virginia, in Oklahoma, where else? In Arkansas, in a number of other states last spring. It was incredible. States across the South were shut down because these were all right-to-work states, and the only recourse these teachers had were to go on strike. And so it's obviously called a strike or a work stoppage. But there's also boycotts. Let's say you work in an industry and you know there's a problem with that industry. Maybe it's the way that workers are treated. Maybe it's the cleanliness conditions. Maybe it's health and safety code violations. You just know that there are serious problems, not just at your place, but at all the places. So what are you going to do about it? You're going to tell your friends. You know, don't buy the meat at Ingles. Ugh. You know, actually, I do buy the meat at Ingles. It's great. But, you know, maybe you saw something I didn't, and you have a problem with that. Okay, so don't buy the meat at Ingles. Ugh. You know, boycott. That's something you can do to hurt that business until they have to listen. Now, on the flip side, management is not without their rights. Management can lock out their workers. You know, maybe you say, you know, Naomi files a grievance with Little Caesars and they decide to go on strike. Little Caesars can say, you know what? We have a stack of applications in the back. You guys go home. We'll find new people. And don't come back until you're willing to work for the conditions that we offer. You take the pay that we're going to offer. You take the hours that we're going to offer. That's the bottom line. Take it or leave it. That's called a lockout. And honestly, that's a powerful tool. Because what are you supposed to do? I mean, what can you do in that situation? And this is honestly where a lot of folks hit dead ends and where a lot of labor movements have to grow much bigger to become effective. And then, of course, in extreme circumstances, the government may step in. And in the history of the labor movement, there have been numerous cases where the National Guard have been called in to labor strikes. And, of course, public employees, myself, can join labor unions. We talked about that. Up our discussion on chapter 22, section 3. Again, we're coming down to the big idea that market economies rest upon the fundamental principle of individual freedom for consumers, producers, and workers. We are a free society. We do give you the freedom to choose what you want to make, what you want to buy, and where you want to work. But we also realize that there must be safeguards to protect that freedom. And so again, some of the terms you're going to see: transparency, discrimination, social responsibility, as we go through this. And first question here: what is a business's first responsibility to? You know, and I don't really want to provide you an answer. I want you to just think about this in theory. You know, we've talked an awful lot about corporations, about how their ultimate purpose is to generate revenue for their shareholders. You know, who is a business responsible to ultimately? Is it the owners? Is it the employees, the community, or the customers? And again, how you would answer that really determines what kind of business you would run. Now, when you go corporate, again, by law, your job is to generate revenue for your shareholders. So the soul kind of comes out of this question. But if you start to make and sell a thing, well, it's your right to choose what you want to prioritize on this list. So again, corporate maybe has no soul because that's the law. They now have to generate revenue for their shareholders. Again, what is Twitter's purpose? To generate revenue for its shareholders. What is Snapchat's purpose in life? To generate revenue for its shareholders. Remember that when you go onto those sites. That's their purpose, is to make money. All else is secondary. What is Baker Bill's purpose? Well, he still has the freedom, being not corporate, to choose. Okay, so. Now, as we talk about the roles of businesses really do more than just produce goods and services. Now, at their very basic level, yes, they produce goods or services. You know, if Bailey decides to sell her knitted goods, at the very basic level, that's what she does. She makes knitted goods, she sells them, she keeps the money. But what else do they do? They have other roles in the economy. For example, she's got to buy the yarn. Now, I'm going to guess that she doesn't make the yarn. That'd be really cool if you sourced everything yourself, but how much work would that be, really? Like, would it be worth it at that point?
I don't know. There's a lot of satisfaction that comes with, like, making your own yarn.
Yeah, and I mean, I've never made my own yarn. I've picked cotton. I've run it through the machine that pulls the seeds out, and I've seen the process of turning cotton into yarn. But and again, like, there may be that inherent level of satisfaction, but the point is, it's so much work that it might not be economically viable if she were trying to run a business. It might be actually cheaper for her just to buy the yarn and to turn it into the knitted product. So that would make her a consumer. I mean, unless she had the land to grow the cotton, to turn the cotton into the yarn herself, all the machinery, okay, great, then she is vertically integrated. But probably she's buying yarn and then doing the thing with it. So she's a consumer. She might also be an employer. You know, let's say that she makes the yarn. Well, okay, she can have a limited distribution just by selling to people she knows, but ultimately she is going to have to rely on others to get her product out. Even if she is the sole producer of the knitted product, she can call it whatever she wants, Bailey's knitted stuff, or I'm no good with names. So she calls it what she wants, and then she distributes it, and then she's hiring people to distribute her product. That makes her an employer. And guess what? She might choose, and really this is that, you know, how she wants to run her business, what she wants to be seen as. She might be a philanthropist, meaning that she might be passionate about a certain nonprofit or charitable organization, and she might give some proceeds from her business to that charitable organization. And really, the system incentivizes her to do so because she gets to write that off on her taxes. She doesn't have to pay taxes on the money that she gives to charity. So maybe she's passionate about animals. She gives to the Humane Society. She gets to write that off. Okay. Now, the next question. Can you think of any companies in your community that do community service? Absolutely. Most of the good companies in our community do some form of community service. You know, for example, my wife at Piscaforest Elementary runs Angel Tree. It's like a Christmas program that we do for needy children. So we adopt a kid. Businesses adopt a kid. That's a form of community service and outreach that they do. So what responsibilities do businesses have? You know, and this is, again, when I'm talking about responsibility, some of these are actually required by law, but they have a responsibility not only to themselves to make money, but sure. You know, she's not making knitted products out of the goodness of her heart. She wants to make money out of it. But she has a responsibility. To who? Well, to consumers. Number one, to make a safe product. To make a safe product. You know, there's an assignment somewhere toward the end of the course called the Consumer Warning Labels Assignment. And we're going to skip it for time's sake. But there's a funny video in there if you click on it. From an SNL skit dating all the way back to the 1980s where Dan Aykroyd was playing a corrupt businessman. And he was making unsafe products for children because they were cheap. And it's hyperbolized, it's exaggerated. He's making things like pile of broken glass. He's making things like child flamethrower. He's making things like bag of nails. Extremely dangerous products and trying to sell them off as children toys. And, of course, the joke is that they're very unsafe. It's very irresponsible of his business to make those products. Businesses also have a responsibility to make a product that works as promised. And this is classic. You know, say, for example, in terms of phones, I'm a Pixel fan. So the Pixel 3 is rolling out. It's already came out. And guess what? Just like any rollout of a new digital product, there's all kinds of bugs. Things that you would have thought they would have caught in production, they would have caught in testing, like obvious stuff like the camera, has inherent flaws. Some of them are hardware flaws, meaning they will have to recall the product, replace the little thing, and then send it back out. So they sent it out as an inferior product. You know, Bethesda is famous for this and rolling out games that aren't quite finished. I don't know if Red Dead had any flaws when they rolled it out or if they tested it long enough. A Pixel fan, like, I was a bit miffed by that, and I'm kind of glad that I'm satisfied with my current phone, and I don't plan on replacing my current phone for a few more years because And I've learned my lesson about buying any product when it first comes out, because even though a business theoretically should make products that work as they promised, we know that's not the real world. Honesty. Again, in theory, businesses will be honest. You know, in theory, the free market would incentivize this. You make a product, it works as advertised, lots of people buy said product. Those are the businesses that are successful. But we also know that in the real world, who are often the wealthiest corporations? Sometimes the most dishonest. Let's think about the richest man on earth, unless it's changed. Is it still Bill Gates?
It's
Bezos. Oh, Bezos now. Okay, so Amazon guy, is that right?
Yeah.
Okay, so Amazon guy. I don't know as much about the history of their corporation. I do know that there have been a lot of labor issues that they've been working through. There's lots of, there's kind of lots of hostile takeovers. They're driving out entire industries. But the one I know more about is Microsoft. If you've ever watched or read any biographies about Bill Gates, where did he get the idea for Windows that made him so wealthy? It's okay if you don't know. Windows came from a collaboration between Bill Gates, Steve Wozniak, which is funny, no one knows his name, but he was just another one of them, and Steve Jobs. The three were good friends working in their garage on a shoestring budget, and they developed a visual user interface for computers. There was no name for it yet. It was still in beta form. It was very, very primitive. But the idea was a collaboration between the three of them. And Bill Gates stole it and became, for a time, the richest man on earth. Now, it's an idea that he stole. But did he win? Yeah, he was the richest man on earth for quite a long time. Now, okay, he's given much of that money back to charity. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation is a great philanthropist of schools, and they're part of the reason the early college exists. Isn't that weird, though, right? If you think about it, the early college might not exist had he not stolen one of the most valuable products on the earth at that time. And here we are. Okay, so honesty. Fairness. Again, was it fair for him to do that? No. You know, the free market doesn't encourage fairness. You know, if you think about it, social Darwinism, survival of the fittest, what does that incentivize? Strength, cunning, tenacity. It's an anti-moral philosophy. And again, in terms of a business's responsibility to its consumers, fairness. But unfortunately, a free market doesn't necessarily encourage that. And that's why the bottom line is it is the job of the government to enforce these things. We the people. So we the people have to care enough to watch, to be aware, to hold accountable. Now, what responsibilities to owners does a business have? Number one, transparency. Transparency. That means the process of making business deals more visible to everyone. So if my business profits and I am a responsible business owner, I communicate those profits to all of my partners. But again, think about if you can cheat and get away with it, you win in a free market system. If Bailey sells an extra $100,000 worth of her product and she does not disclose that information to Chrissy, remember they're partners in this venture, so she does not disclose that information to Chrissy, that means Bailey gets to keep all of the $100,000 and she doesn't have to share it with her partner. Go Bailey! Woo! Now, obviously that's cheating. Does it happen in the business world? Absolutely. Okay, so the purpose of this responsibility to owners is that if you go into business, once more, maybe you're a sole proprietor. Maybe you're accountable to no one. If so, be proud of that. That's, you know, I mean, that's as American as it gets, that you're the rugged individualist, that you made it on your own. Be proud of that. But it's not likely. It's not. You know, I like the speech that former President Obama gave at the end of his tenure, where he said that every American business is beholden to the people. If for no other reason than they're driving on roads that were built by the people. And they're being kept safe by the police who are paid for by the people. And that they're utilizing public goods and services that are provided by the people. And so what he was trying to make the case of is that every American business, as independent as you might want to think yourselves, is dependent on the whole. And I thought that was a brilliant way to put it, because in the end, you're all dependent on someone. And yes, to be an ethical business, you must be transparent about your business. And once more, the government enforces this. Secondly, I want to emphasize the importance of this. You see, transparency is crucial so that the owners of a said business can make good decisions about who they would like to support and who they would not. You know, in theory, if Bailey and Chrissy both fully disclosed all the information about their business, were fully transparent with one another, it should allow their business to thrive. Now, if Bailey's skimming money from the business or Chrissy's skimming money from the business, the point is that ultimately hurts the business. Now, sure, it hurts the other person, but more importantly, it hurts the business, because those are profits. That $100,000 would have been far better spent as a reinvestment into the business. But Bailey took it and did some cool thing with it. Great. But she's hurt her own business. And once more, so full transparency, even on the corporate level, is important for the health of that business. Okay, so response to employees. And once more, these are regulated by the government. You know, it is the job of, say, the Federal Trade Commission, the National Labor Relations Board, the Better Business Bureau, et cetera, et cetera. There are agencies that monitor these things. And so the responsibility that a workplace has to its employees is safety. I don't know about you guys, but I've worked in some unsafe jobs that were inherently dangerous. And you accept that as part of working in those jobs. You know, once upon a time, I wanted to be a firefighter. I wanted to be a wildland firefighter. My dream was to jump out of airplanes and put out fires in the wilderness. I went through this. I became certified to do all of that. It was going to be awesome. And life led me toward education instead. And I may still revisit that. I may be the old retired 50-year-old still jumping out of airplanes, putting out fires. So that may be what your teacher goes on to do someday. I get that's an inherently dangerous occupation, but I accept that. Now, and I'm sure I'd have to sign some waiver about, do you realize how dumb you are by taking this job? Yes, 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 yes. And I accept that. But I don't accept walking into this building with the threat of being blown up by someone. You know, I expect a safe working environment in this job. Now, granted, if I trip and fall on the sidewalk, that's on me. But if the building collapses on me, that's on whoever made the building, right? As an employer, Henderson County Public Schools owes me a safe working environment. No discrimination. Now, this is just, yes, it's one of those ethical things, but just like ethics, just like morals, it's not something that people naturally do, you know? And that's unfortunate. Yes, I mean, you can train yourself to not discriminate, but people are naturally discriminatory. And that's unfortunate, yes, but that's an aspect of human nature. Just like corruption, you know, people tend toward corruption. So, by discrimination, I just want to mean unfair treatment based on prejudice against a certain group. Businesses are required by federal law not to discriminate. Doesn't mean they don't. And that's why, again, the watchful, resolute interference of we the people. You know, who is the burden of accusation on? Well, it's on the victim, unfortunately. Is that if you are the victim of discrimination and you don't report it, then it goes unchecked. And so, yeah, I mean, it's unfortunate that's where we are, but once more, these responsibilities on the business are often accountable by the people. So in terms of a responsibility to a community, you know, if you go into the business world, I mean, you're going to do so to make money. You can make far more money than anything in the public sector if you go into the business world. But remember to be ethical. You know, remember to be good to your community in return. And that's that social responsibility. It could be giving to charity. It could be volunteering. It could be supporting the schools. It could be disaster relief. Again, there are so many ways to give back. Finally, should businesses have social responsibility? And that's just one that you can think about for yourself. There's no law that says a business has to be good to the community. But it definitely helps their bottom line, at least theoretically. I mean, that's why businesses do it ultimately. It does. It helps get their name out to spread their positive.